WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Hoffman, writes about what he describes as one of the grandest, most arduous experiments ever attempted to transform a vast country in the grip of failed socialism into an economy of free market capitalism. His new book is called The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. Hoffman was the Washington Post's Moscow bureau chief from 1995 to 2001. He's now the foreign editor. His book focuses on six men who became architects and apostles of Russia's new order: Alexander Smolensky, Boris Berezovsky, Vladimir Guzinsky, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Yuri Lyshkov, and Anatol Chubais. Hoffman says these six bought up the Russian mass media, especially television, and they seized not only factories, but also the assets of the state itself, including the budget, the law enforcement system, and the Kremlin leadership. They were secretive, deceptive, and at times ruthlessly violent. I asked Hoffman about the media mogul in the book, Vladimir Guzinsky. He founded NTV, which became Russia's largest and most successful private TV channel.
It was the only independent station outside the control of the state, and suddenly the state had a crisis, and that was the war in Chechnya. The first war in Chechnya, which began in late 1994 and went on in early 1995, was broadcast in television news in a way that Russians had never seen before. You have to understand that the war in Afghanistan did not appear on Soviet television, but these brave and courageous correspondents for NTV went down and covered that war from both sides, and it was a brutal war, and the entire population saw this for the first time on a station that hadn't even existed. And you know what happened? The ratings just went way through the roof. The ratings went up because people wanted to find out what was the truth of the war. And this station, I must say, showed the truth as the tapes came in. They just slapped them in the machine and put them on the air. This is not, we're not talking about sophisticated, slick programming or documentaries. We're talking about night after night of war reportage. And in Moscow, which, of course, is sort of the center of the intelligentsia, and I would say probably the most liberal and certainly the most prosperous city in Russia, NTV's ratings just climbed and climbed and climbed, and it came at the expense of state television. It demonstrated, actually, that television was a medium that could be immensely powerful in this new, young state.
How big did Guzinsky's media empire get?
Well, it got pretty big and pretty influential. And one of the things is this. The big station, the one that Berezovsky had, which dated from Soviet times, covered the entire country. And it had satellites. It was the station you could see anywhere in the former Soviet Union. Guzinsky created a station from scratch, putting this piece together, that piece together, creating a regional network, then buying his own satellites, private satellites, outside the control of the state. And one of the reasons that his media empire became so influential and so big is that it was good. It was the most professional. It had the freshest and sometimes the most challenging news. Even the communists and the nationalists and all the parties in Russia wanted to be on that television station because they knew that's where the livelihood discussion was. And the state media, which were still stale and dull, and some of the others in between, which were partially state-owned, lost ground.
What happened to his media empire last April?
When President Putin came in, Guzinsky had been closely allied with Mayor Lyshkov of Moscow, and Putin was not fond of him. Putin launched in the first year in office a campaign against Guzinsky's media empire. He did things like urge banks to call in his loans, send masked men with guns to raid his headquarters for documents, to have Gazprom, the state natural gas monopoly, twist Guzinsky's arm. And Putin carried out a year-long campaign to effectively destroy Guzinsky's media empire. And last April, he succeeded. Guzinsky left the country and had to give up his media empire.
And where is he living now?
In Greenwich, Connecticut, as far as I know, and in New York.
Does he have a lot of money left?
Oh, I think he's doing very well. Guzinsky has part of the Israeli newspaper Maariv. He has other investments. I think that he's still interested in Russia. As you know, one of his TV stations was recently closed down, and many of his staff are still there. He's also backing a magazine in Russia. I think that we have not heard the last of him.
Are any of the other oligarchs that you write about living in exile from Russia now?
Yes, Boris Berezovsky is living in London, as far as I know, and Berezovsky was the sort of elder statesman of the oligarchs. He was the most prominent, as I said, and in many ways the most public of them all in the period of the Roaring 90s, and he also had a falling out with Putin.
Over?
Well, you remember when the Kursk submarine sank? And Berezovsky's television station broadcast rather blunt reports raising questions about whether the government was telling the truth. And also, they broadcast some tape showing Putin on holiday at the time that the submarine sank, and underscoring the rather slow reaction of the Kremlin and of Putin to this catastrophe. And Putin got really mad about that and called Berezovsky into the Kremlin. And Berezovsky says to Putin, look, I'm helping you. You didn't do this. This is open information. I'm trying to help you get through this. And but Putin wouldn't hear of it. And Putin said, I want to take this television station back. I want to have it under my control. Berezovsky saw the writing on the wall. He had seen what had happened to Gusinski. He sold the television station and got out of the country.
Who did he sell it to?
He sold it to another oligarch who essentially turned it over to the control of the Kremlin. And he sold it to an oligarch who had been a partner of his previously, Abramovich, who was under the influence of the Kremlin. So by selling it, I don't think Berezovsky made a profit. I think he actually lost a fair amount of money, but mostly he just wanted to get out.
What were some of the financially tricky parts for you of living and working in the 90s in Russia during this transitional period from communism to capitalism?
Well, it was an exciting time. I feel that there's very few times in your life when someone will give you a ringside seat at a country completely remaking itself. You know, right before my eyes and sort of fast forward, I got to watch how Russia was zooming through this history. And zooming is the only way I know how to describe it. You'd go away for a week or two and you'd come back and you find out a whole new set of events had occurred. And one of those most interesting to me was the way that the people regarded their money. You know, Russians were very distrustful of the ruble and of the whole idea of the money. They kept their money in dollars under mattresses because they just didn't know when the government was going to come and screw them, as it had many times before. So it was interesting for me to watch how attitudes changed. And there was a period there, you know, in 1996 and 97, where Russia had a real boom, had a stock market boom, the economy started to take off. We now realize some of the causes were artificial, but what was most interesting was at the beginning of 1998, they announced to signify stability and calm that they were going to take the ruble, which was then 6,000 to the dollar, and they were going to cut the three zeros off the end of the money. Really, they would have no economic impact, but it's just having six instead of 6,000, you can imagine how this made them feel more secure. But, of course, the people who were working on this campaign to change the money were very worried that Russians would panic, they would give up their ruble, something terrible would happen. And it was supposed to happen on January 1st. And I have to admit, I also was worried that something terrible was going to happen. And, you know, what happened was nothing. People took it in stride. And the next day, the ruble was six to the dollar. Well, this experiment led Chubais and some others to be unnecessarily sanguine about what they had accomplished because later in that year, the ruble crashed and had to be devalued. But it was a very interesting set of events that suggest to me that Russians actually are very sensitive, despite 70 years of socialism, that they are striving and are very sensitive to what a market economy should be.
You described Chubais, the economic reformer, as the architect of the largest transfer in history of state-owned assets to private hands. What system did he come up with for that transfer?
Well, if you have to remember that when the Soviet Union collapsed so quickly and so suddenly, all these state-owned enterprises, big oil refineries, some as big as American oil companies, were up for grabs. And there was a big question about who would control them, who would own them. And, of course, many of them had directors and guys from the Soviet era that had run them that were trying to take control. And Chubais decided that the best way to get this property into private hands was to do it by issuing a piece of paper that was called a voucher. And this voucher had a face value that would entitle each person in the country to get a little little bit of property. You could then take the voucher and turn it in for shares of stock in a company. You could sell it for cash. But the idea being that the property would be given to all 140 million people in the country. Now, it didn't work out that way completely because there were many problems with it. But it was an effort to take that property, which suddenly had been in the hands of the Soviet state and was now up for grabs, and give it to as many people as possible. What happened, of course, was that the oligarchs and the tycoons got a big chunk of it themselves, and it didn't wind up in the hands of 140 million people.
How did they get the big chunk?
They got it because they could buy up and accumulate these vouchers. They could go to board meetings when the decisions about shares were being made. They could create phony companies and use money from offshore funds to try and buy up parts of the companies. They could merge with others. So they used a lot of shady schemes to try and consolidate their hold. And in the mid-90s, there was a period called Loans for Shares. And it was 1995. It was a set of auctions of the very biggest, richest companies. And these auctions were rare. And these auctions allowed the tycoons to get some of the very biggest companies that they have today.
As you say in your book, Chubais initially thought that the free market would work things out. If a good person bought the factory, a good business person bought the factory, it would succeed. And if not, it would fail. Someone else would come along and buy it. And the marketplace would handle it. But as you say, there weren't key institutions that kind of regulate a marketplace. Capitalism wasn't in place. There was no system. There were no controls, and the economy was just out of control.
Terry, at the very beginning, when Yeltsin and Chubais and Gaidar were putting this together, you have to remember that the entire formative experience of their lives was that state power was too strong. The entire Soviet experience led them to believe the state had overweening power against enterprises, individuals. So when they got a chance to sort of free things up, they decided, I think explicitly, let's go for maximum freedom first. I like to say this was like a boxing ring, and they decided, let's let the boxers loose on each other. And, the boxers will come up with the rules later on. They had to move quickly. They believed they had to move very quickly. They decided to let free markets loose without rules at the beginning. And it shaped all the years that followed, because this great struggle to develop rules and that govern all mature market economies took a lot of time, and even today is incomplete. And I'll give you a really good example of this. When they first allowed stock shares, securities to be bought and sold, which came out of the period when they created those vouchers I mentioned, they triggered a whole group of pyramid schemes, of rip-off schemes, where people were just creating pyramids and offering 1,000% returns, a get-rich-quick schemes. And they were stunned that this is what happened, because they thought people were going to create mutual funds. And instead, the pyramids got out of control. And it was only after a lot of the population lost their money in these pyramids that they decided to create a Securities and Exchange Commission to regulate securities, to create the rules of a market economy. That happened only after the mistake.
My guest is David Hoffman, and he was the Washington Post Moscow bureau chief from 1995 to 2001. He's now the paper's foreign editor. His new book is called The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Hoffman. His new book is called The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. He's the former Moscow bureau chief of the Washington Post and current foreign editor. Is the fact that there really wasn't any economic system in place responsible in part for the amount of bribery and economic corruption that grew with the end of the Soviet communist system?
No, this is absolutely true. Corruption has been a feature of Russian life for centuries. But at the end of the Soviet system, the new laws and the new rules were just coming into play. But what came into play faster and with much greater force was this onrushing capitalism. So you can imagine these oligarchs and tycoons buy up factories. They get in disputes. They get in arguments. This one's mine. That one's yours. And how do they settle those? There's no courts to settle them in yet. So they begin to settle them by not only on simple methods like fighting it out on the street, but on more sophisticated methods. They start to buy the police forces. They start to buy the security forces. They start to fight each other with the tools of the state. They privatize the state this way. Then you can see what developed was money ruled the state, not the state ruling the money.
Well, you make an interesting point in the book. You basically say if laws are unenforceable or non-existent, then just about anyone could be found at fault. And what's the connection between that and bribery?
Well, the connection is that bribery stems from when someone has arbitrary power, right? So if anybody can be found at fault, then anybody can be charged. So the way out of it is that is to bribe yourself out of it. And in all societies where you find that there's arbitrary and authoritarian power, it's much more likely, if you can't appeal to a court to settle the dispute, if you don't feel that there's a rule of law or a process, that you're just going to arbitrarily find your exit door.
What's an example of a law that was unenforceable or arbitrary and bribery was the way around it and bribery became really commonplace in that area?
Well, there were, for example, customs duties and rules about what you could import and export. But at the time, if you remember, the price of oil in Russia was not completely freed to global prices. So inside the country, oil was much cheaper than abroad. So if you could get a truckload or even a trainload of oil from someplace in Russia to Estonia, you could make a fortune. And there are guys who made a fortune. To get that train across the border, you had to pay somebody because you didn't want to pay those customs duties. And of course, then once you made your profit on selling the oil, there was a big demand in the early years for computers, which Russia had a lot fewer of and the Soviet Union had very few of. So you bought some computers and you had to bring them back in. And again, you had to pay a bribe to the customs inspector to get them back in. And this became one of the major areas of bribery.
Did you ever have to bribe people during your daily life in Russia?
It was very, very common in Moscow in the time I was there. Whenever a traffic policeman stopped you, he expected not to give you a ticket, but for you to pay him a small fee. Call it a bribe. Yes, it was a bribe. And I often paid it. It was a lot easier than going down to the police station.
And what would have happened if you didn't pay?
If you didn't pay, generally they would take your license away and give you a little ticket, and you would have to take that ticket and maybe weeks or months later come down to the police station and try and get your license back. The formal system was very bureaucratic, very Soviet, full of stamps and papers, but the easier system was simply to pay the guy on the street. Also, another thing is that the traffic cops made up the rules as they went along. One time I was making a left turn, right from a left turn lane, and the guy pulled me over. Now, he could say that I had broken the law in some obscure way, and maybe he was right, but he did it mostly because he wanted to be paid. You know, there was an old joke in Moscow that when you rolled down the window, the traffic cop would say, "Hello, my name is Ivan, father of three," and put out his hand.
And what did you think of the media? The independent stations that you were describing that were controlled by one of the oligarchs you write about. What do you think of their media coverage?
You have to understand that in a very early phase like this, the government was chaotic, politics was chaotic, everything about the new Russia at that time was very uncertain. So at one level, I admire some of these journalists. I think they were courageous. I think some of them were doing things that they had no experience for, they had no training for. On the other hand, you have to remember that the Soviet-era media didn't go away. It wasn't like everybody just disappeared and a new crew came in. The same people were working. So this transition to this gradual shift from a media environment where the state was in control, told you what to say, to a free society where you were free to criticize, was very painful. It took a lot of time. And let me give you an example. In the 1996 election, when Yeltsin was running against the communists, a lot of the journalists believed that this was a very black and white case, and they threw their enthusiastic support behind Yeltsin. They wrote pro-Yeltsin articles, and of course some of them were paid to do this, but many of them just did it voluntarily. Now, the Russian media has a disease. It's infected with something called kompromat. Kompromat is faked material, faked documents, smear material, the kind of things that you would use in the media to hurt an enemy. And one of the big problems after the Soviet Union collapsed in the new Russia was the proliferation of this kompromat. And this is very tricky stuff because you can't always tell if it's real or not. If somebody wants to smear you, they make this up. So in Yeltsin's election campaign, of all places, I mean, we're talking about the president, in his election campaign, they prepared what essentially was kompromat. Mott. It was an article that would be published in a newspaper saying that the Communist Party was going to do all these terrible things if they won. Well, let me explain what happened. The article was published in a major newspaper. Remember, it was so-called leaked. It was published in the paper. And guess what? The next day, President Yeltsin has an interview with a top television anchor. And of course, the first thing out of his mouth is, did you see that article in the newspaper showing what the Communists would do? Well, the whole thing was a plant. The whole thing was a setup. The journalists were complicit in this, and they did it willingly.
What's President Putin's relationship now with the oligarchs?
Putin decided to change the players, but some of the oligarchs he's allowed to stay. He basically made a deal with those who would stay. He said, you stay out of Kremlin politics, and you can keep your winnings. You can keep the big oil refineries and the metals and all the big things you got in the 90s, but don't tell me what to do anymore. So I think there's an uneasy coexistence. I think that the businessmen themselves realize that the state could come after them at any time. And I think that Putin, in his own mind, is happy to have some of these businessmen, but is very resentful and hostile to the idea that they should interfere with his decisions and with the Kremlin.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Hoffman is the author of The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in the New Russia. He's the foreign editor of The Washington Post and is the paper's former Moscow bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.